From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, the New York Times reported that soon after September 11th, the National Security Agency began eavesdropping on American citizens. Under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, the government can legally conduct such operations as long as it obtains a warrant from the FISA court. But the NSA never sought those warrants, as the Times disclosed after holding its story for more than a year. We'll discuss why the Times took so long in a few moments, but first, some background. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was enacted in 1978 to prevent the kinds of surveillance abuses common during the civil rights era and the Vietnam War. Since then, the FISA court has rarely denied a requested warrant. The big unanswered question? Why the government didn't ask for any in this case? Here with some possible answers is William Arkin, author of the Washington Post blog Early Warning, which often addresses military and security issues. He says the administration had two reasons for sidestepping the FISA court.
The first is a justification on the part of the administration that the time frame for seeking a FISA warrant was too long, and thereby they needed to move quickly. The second is that there are some technological changes which have occurred, realities associated with modern surveillance of potential terrorists, which necessitate the government not seek the permission of the court.
Well, let's unpack those assertions. The first one about speed seems easily answered, since you could go ahead, surveil somebody, eavesdrop on someone, and under the FISA regulations, you could actually acquire the warrant after the fact, right?
It has 15 days and then 45 days as a threshold under which it can still seek a warrant. So the argument, at least in itself, that there was a need for quick movement on the part of the government doesn't stand up to scrutiny unless you combine it with the other argument that the government is making, which is it is the nature of the information that they are collecting which necessitates them circumventing the FISA system.
Explain that one to me.
Well, here's the rub. FISA is set up with the notion that what you are doing is you're seeking a warrant to surveil a person, Bill Arkin, so that you can conduct electronic surveillance or wiretapping or other types of surveillance of his email, telephone calls, etc. But what if the government, in fact, is doing something very different after 9/11? They're not targeting a person per se. They are acquiring massive amounts of data. Every telephone call between the United States and Pakistan or between the United States and Afghanistan, every email message that transits a certain port in the United States, by the acquisition of that massive amount of data, what they are doing is they are inadvertently and promiscuously collecting information about and dealing with U.S. persons, but they're not targeting them until that information churns through various data mining and link analysis softwares until they are then coming upon potential terrorists or potential Americans or U.S. persons who are linked to terrorism.
The NSA does make a distinction, I guess, between what it calls hunting for information, as spying on you, Bill Arkin might be, and gathering, which is trolling the information networks for keywords and possible threats to the United States. So it would seem to me that this would call for a different legal response than that which is offered by FISA.
Well, I think that there's a valid case that the government is probably going to make in hearings before Congress in the coming days and weeks, that in fact the times they are a-changing and that they require different mechanisms for conducting lawful surveillance.
Well, if there was doubt about the legality of the program, why didn't the White House work with Congress to craft new legislation?
Perhaps it's the case that the notion that you're telling the American public that no email, no phone call, no credit card receipt, no driver's license is safe any longer because with our new digital databases and capabilities, we can suck all of that information together. I think the American public wouldn't have been a very understanding necessarily of that new government capacity. Much of this information never even passes through human hands or is looked at by a set of human eyeballs. It is just churned through these layers upon layers of information extraction software tools. And I think for that reason, the 1978 law is no longer sufficient to protect American rights and civil liberties while the government is in fact protecting us.
If all this information goes through, perhaps without human eyes ever seeing it, what's the harm?
Well, you know, I'll admit to you, Brooke, that when I first started thinking about this program after the New York Times stories, I thought to myself, I'm not really worried about this because I know that the government is focusing its attention on a few elements of American society, mostly Muslims, let's be honest, who are connected to Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Middle East. Doesn't affect me. And I'll admit to you, that was my initial reaction. But it is the building of these tools and capacities to collect this enormous amount of information and then analyze it and aggregate it that opens the way for government abuses tomorrow. And so that's why we need to have laws which regulate what the government can collect and how it can collect it and how it can retain that information, not so that we can shield or protect those who may in fact be connected to transnational terrorist organizations, but that we can protect American citizens in the future from any kind of government mischief should somebody want to undertake it.
All right. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bill Arkin is the author of Early Warning, a Washington Post blog about national and homeland security.
The New York Times held its story about secret NSA eavesdropping for more than a year after senior administration officials expressed concerns about national security. The most senior administration official had this to say after the paper ran with the story last week.
It was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in time of war.
According to Newsweek, President Bush even summoned the Times editor and publisher to the Oval Office before the story went to press. Scott Armstrong is the current co-chair of a dialogue between intelligence agencies and the media. He joins us now. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
What is the process by which a story like this first develops, and how does it get to the point where senior government officials get involved?
Well, this is a kind of extraordinary example of a regular process that national security reporters go through. In an era when almost everything is classified, most of our conversations begin it with confidential sources and then work in the direction of trying to document something that is a secret, something that's not well known. And as you get closer to publication, you really engage in a much more explicit discussion of what you're going to say. And you get feedback, sometimes at very senior levels.
How is a reporter to know whether there's really something at stake here or whether the senior administration officials are just crying wolf?
Well, when you start the story, you're talking to people on a background basis or off-the-record basis, and often you'll get information. They'll say, look, there's a huge policy debate in the administration. I'm on one side of it, some other people on the other side of it, but here's what the debate's about. They may say at some point, well, by way of illustration, here's the sort of thing that's been occurring. But then they'll say, but you cannot use that. You're getting a lot of feedback about what it is that people think is legitimate to talk about and what their concerns are. So by the time the administration, that is to say, the more political entity that wants to shape and control the news, which is what, frankly, most security classification is about, by the time they get involved, you usually already know what it is that's safe to print. It's pretty extraordinary when they come and they say, gee, you can't talk about this at all. You really shouldn't. That's very singular.
So how unusual is it for a paper actually to say, you know, upon further reflection, we're not going to print the entire story. We're going to delete this portion of it. Is that common practice?
almost every important national security story has something that is not in the story. It's not the job of the national security reporter to do something that might damage the national security. So there are things that you begin to say, gee, I wonder if I really need to say that. Will the reader or the viewer or the listener learn something that's absolutely critically important if I put in the name of a unit or I begin to talk about something, particularly something that's new? So you begin to test with your sources that, and they will quite often say, don't put in that specific a reference in the case of an intercept, because that will compromise the system. And frankly, we've been trying to get reporters more educated about what it is that the intelligence professionals, as opposed to the political actors in the administration, what they're really sensitive about, because it hurts the intelligence business.
Now, we've been talking in general to this point. With this story, which is about the National Security Agency listening in to telephone calls principally, it's hard to see what in the story would have been deemed so sensitive as to hold it for a year. There's certainly no secret about the fact, and there's, I guess, no terrorist even unaware of the fact that the American spy agencies can monitor telephone calls.
You have to look at this story that the New York Times has done as one cross-section of a larger story, a larger picture. And if you try and play back from this particular story to what took them a year to do this, you're missing the point that there are many other factors that they still haven't fully decided to report on or haven't decided how they're going to say or haven't confirmed. And as the story developed, they were, I think, not aware that this was as much in variance with what's legal and what's considered to be within the proper function of the National Security Agency and the proper function of warrants for wiretaps. And they began to look at what the issues were. Is it extra legal? Is it something that ought to be debated in a constitutional system? And they finally concluded that it was, and that's the part that they published.
How much does the history of the Times' relationship with the government affect its behavior and the Bush administration's in this particular case?
Historically, they have had the willingness to suppress information. The Bay of Pigs was something that they soft-pedaled, lowered their story and profile on. They moved people around from different bureaus at the complaints of the intelligence community all through the 50s and 60s. You also had this notion more recently that the Times had a reporter, Judy Miller, who was extremely compliant with some of the interests of the administration and seemed to be reporting things that they were feeding her with some regularity, and it raised questions about their independence. That has not been their practice from the mid-1970s, when they broke the original stories about domestic spying, where NSA was spying on American citizens, through recent times. They've been very aggressive reporters, very professional, and the editorial process has been exactly what you would want it to be, constantly questioning where things are going.
All right, Scott. Well, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Scott Armstrong is a former Washington Post reporter and now co-chair of an ongoing dialogue between intelligence agencies and the media that cover them.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In a news conference Monday, the president sought to convey the damage wrought by the New York Times story on government eavesdropping with an earlier example of media gone wild. In the late 90s, he said, U.S. intelligence was tracking Osama bin Laden through his satellite phone.
And then the fact that we were following Osama bin Laden because he was using a certain type of telephone made it into the press as a result of a leak. And guess what happened? Osama bin Laden changed his behavior.
Well, the president should fire his fact checkers, shouldn't they? They've made a fool out of him.
Martin Seif reported that story, essentially a clip job of bin Laden's activities, in August 1998 in the Washington Times. In the 22nd paragraph, he noted that bin Laden, quote, keeps in touch with the world via computers and satellite phones and has given occasional interviews to international news organizations, including Time Magazine and CNN News. There was nothing about us tracking his phone. Nor was Seif the first to mention Osama's phone.
It's obvious these people were incompetent. If they'd done a NexusLexus search, they would have found the earlier stories.
Namely, in Time magazine and on CNN. Also, CBS. And on the same day as Seif's story, USA Today. But only Seif gets the credit. Since 9/11, the damage he wrought has been invoked in countless newspapers, chat shows, and even in the 9/11 report, where three sources are footnoted, one with just an initial suggesting a highly placed intelligence official. This week it was cited again in Slate by former National Security Council staffer Daniel Benjamin. In defending the New York Times against the president's attacks this week, he wrote that the New York Times piece did not compromise U.S. intelligence, but the Washington Times piece did. Quote, if there was one piece of intelligence in the entire file on bin Laden that might have spelled the difference between 9/11 happening or not, the satellite phone was it. But astoundingly, after years of excoriation, Seif never felt a thing until Benjamin's Slate story. Martin Seif.
The first I learned of it was when Benjamin attacked me by name in Slate.com this week. I think I'm long overdue for a personal apology from him.
I will be happy to correct it, as I said, if this turns out to have been a misstatement.
Daniel Benjamin, who made the same charge in his 2002 book, The Age of Sacred Terror, written with a National Security Council colleague, says he's frankly bewildered that the charge against Seif, made by so many for so long, has suddenly been called into question. When he first heard it, the intelligence community was reeling.
I have to, you know, remind you where I was at the time, which is underwater in the National Security Council dealing with two embassies that had just been blown up and a strike against Afghanistan and Sudan. This was the way it was briefed to us. I don't remember anyone sitting us down and saying, and we lost this source because of this, that, or the other. It was in the torrent of information that we were getting at that point.
So you had a briefing in which this Washington Times article was cited.
No, I don't believe there was a formal briefing. What I recall was that everyone in the government at that point was saying, we lost this fantastic source, and this is why.
Is that just sort of a vague recollection, or do you just not want to be revealing your sources and methods here with me?
You know, for all I know, it was my boss who told me you heard it from the CIA. Well, we're dealing with intelligence matters. What choice did I have but to rely on, you know, having two or three sources for a piece of information like that? Look, I wrote that book with the senior director for counterterrorism at the NSC, whose recollection was identical to mine.
It is a prime example of groupthink.
Glenn Kessler is the diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post.
And it's an example of how that groupthink gets out into the world without many people questioning it.
This week, Kessler filed three pieces on the Washington Times 1998 bin Laden story. Thursday's was headlined, File the Bin Laden Phone Leak Under Urban Myths.
It's there in the 9/11 Commission report. I've done some further research. It appears in all sorts of speeches. It's like the poster child of the danger of leaks. And in fact, there are people that want to impose new laws on the media, and this is the main case they point to.
Is it possible that the Washington Times story did inspire bin Laden to turn off his phone?
I don't really think so. There were a number of other publications that also mentioned it at the time. Perhaps the agency has some sort of intercept that we don't know about, in which a particular al-Qaeda person specifically mentions the Washington Times and says, we've got to turn off our satellite phone. I think the more likely thing that happened is that the United States sent dozens of cruise missiles directly at Osama bin Laden's lair and missed him by just a couple of hours. And that kind of event, rather than some reference in the 21st paragraph of a newspaper that doesn't have wide circulation, the event of the cruise missiles is what got him to change his behavior.
If, in fact, the charge against the Washington Times is an urban myth, as you suggest, why do you think it's been so persistent?
Because it's an easy way out for people. rather than say, you know, we took a chance, we sent some cruise missiles at them, we missed them, it's easy for them to point to it and say, we might have prevented 9/11 if we'd been able to listen to a satellite phone. And we weren't able to listen to a satellite phone anymore because of something that the media did.
So, maybe the media did, and maybe they didn't. We do think that Bin Laden's still out there, and if the government can't find him, then at least it will find a good reason why.
Last week, we learned that Jack Abramoff, the indicted lobbyist at the center of a Washington influence peddling scandal, has been paying cash money for op-ed opinions. Among those on his payroll was Doug Bandow of the Cato Institute, who used his Copley News Service column to promote Abramoff's clients. In anticipation of the uproar, Bandow resigned from Cato, and Copley immediately suspended his column. Business Week, which broke the story, quoted Bandow as saying, "It was a lapse of judgment on my part, and I take full responsibility for it." Not so remorseful is Peter Ferreira from a think tank called the Institute for Policy Innovation, who was also caught taking Abramoff's cash for columns. Ferreira told Business Week he does it all the time and will do it again. These sordid doings are red meat for Josh Marshall, who writes the Talking Points Memo blog and has followed such schemes for a long time. He says Abramoff takes money from clients like the Mississippi Choctaw Indian Tribe or the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands and uses it to buy favorable opinions.
So there'd be a column by Doug Bandow in, you know, X and Y regional papers around the country saying, look at the Marianas Islands, they're a showcase of free enterprise. We certainly don't want to ruin it by, you know, having the federal government regulating their companies. Let's, you know, everybody get off the case of the Marianas Islands, etc. And the background, what the readers of these articles didn't know, is that the governments and companies that are big on these islands had hired Jack Abramoff to protect their interests in Washington, and Abramoff had taken some of that money from them, paid Doug Bandow to write newspaper articles supporting them. In practice, I wouldn't think it's that much different from Bandow being someone who writes press releases for a lobbying firm.
What do you make of Ferreira's contention that these are his own views, he held them anyway, so what difference does it make if they coincided with somebody else's interest? What difference does it make if he takes a little extra money on the side? Is that a legitimate defense?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a pretty bogus defense. I mean, again, I think what is somewhat complicated here is that it is all a matter of degree. He works at a think tank that I am sure is subsidized by corporations that agree with those positions that the think tank and he advocate. That is considered okay. There should be disclosure, whatever, but, you know, he already has those views, so why can't they support him and his efforts to propagate those views? When it comes down to writing specific columns about specific clients, about specific pieces of legislation on the direction of a specific lobbyist, he may think that's okay. If he really thinks it's okay, he should probably say in his columns that he's being paid to write those things, because I think it just doesn't pass the laugh test, really, and I think he knows that.
Before we go any farther, let's talk about what a think tank is. Now, it's a research institution, nominally. It's filled with scholars and presumably is coming from some sort of worldview. The Brookings Institution is somewhere on the left. The American Enterprise Institute is somewhere on the right. The Heritage Foundation, certainly on the right. But then there are other things called think tanks that I guess are much closer to pure advocacy organizations, no?
That's right. You do have the more established ones that fit that model of sort of research institutions, but you have a very broad range, and some of them get all their money from one place, get all their money from one industry, and they are basically putting out position papers for that industry's pretty direct economic interests. So in a lot of cases, think tanks are, again, hard to distinguish in a lot of ways from lobbying shops, just they're more lobbying to the public than lobbying one or two members of Congress.
So shouldn't there be some sort of agreement between newspapers and contributors in which the contributor has to certify that there is no hidden third party subsidizing the opinion?
I think in the case of most papers, it's such an obvious thing that it's just sort of assumed. You know, newspapers also assume you haven't plagiarized the column. They assume a lot of things. you often do have to sign an agreement when you write a column saying that, you know, this is my work, et cetera. And it could well be that those contracts will be rewritten to include something like you say, no one's paid me to write this. These are my genuine own views.
At least in the current outbreak, the culprits seem to get their op-eds in the Washington Times and so forth, the usual suspects on the political right. Is this a widespread practice, or is it just isolated to a few right-wing think tanks and a few right-wing news outlets?
I've reported on this topic for a long time, and the issue of money and think tanks and where think tanks get their money from is an issue that really does cross the political spectrum. However, this kind of very direct thing, where there are actually people taking what amount to payoffs, I have only seen examples of it on the right. I really haven't seen really any instances of it on the leftward side of the spectrum. I think one of the reasons for that is there's a lack of money, frankly, not to be facetious about it, but these are mainly cases of companies that are hiring big ticket lobbyists that are spreading money around Washington. That's where the money is. And conservative editorial pages are the ones that are likely to have the anti-government, anti-regulatory stance to start with, that they're going to be, you know, congenial to this sort of message. So I think it's mainly on the right, and there's sort of, as you can see, sort of inherent reasons why it tends to be on the right, not on the left.
All right, Josh, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Marshall blogs at talkingpointsmemo.com.
Since 1928, the New York-based newspaper The Irish Echo has chronicled the lives and stories of Irish Americans and Irish immigrants in the United States. Driven to leave by famine, colonial rule, and lack of economic opportunity, waves of Irish arrived in New York, Boston, and other East Coast cities over the last 150 years. As the community grew, so did the newspapers that served them. But with the economy of the Emerald Isle booming, immigrants as well as Americans of Irish descent are being lured back to the ancestral home. And so was the Irish Echo, which last month was printed and distributed for the first time in its history in Ireland. Sean McCary is the editor of the Irish Echo, and he joins me now. Sean, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Brooke.
What exactly prompted the decision to print and distribute it in Ireland?
Well, in a nutshell, many of our readers were going back to Ireland. But on top of that, there are lots of Irish Americans who've been travelling to go and live and work in Ireland. If you have one grandparent who was born in Ireland, you have the right to have an Irish passport. So with that in mind, a lot of the multinational companies know that their employees who are of Irish descent don't have to deal with any paperwork at all if they want to switch and work anywhere in the European Union.
So that's interesting. You started out by serving immigrant communities there. Now you're serving immigrant communities back in Ireland.
That's right. That's right. And what we find is that our job was basically always to cover what was happening in Irish America. And we now feel that we can't properly serve Irish America unless we're available on both sides of the Atlantic.
But given the rising cost of newsprint and the fact that internet access is widespread in Ireland, wouldn't it have been easier to just direct Irish readers to the Echo's website?
Sure. If they need information immediately, or if they need a very, very specific type of information, they log onto the internet and they'll find it there. And the Irish Echo has got quite a good internet site. But the thing about the internet is you can't read it on the bus on your way to work. You can't read it if you're sitting in a quiet corner of the pub.
Could you tell me in more detail who your readers are? I understand that they're both Irish people and immigrants from the U.S. of Irish descent, but why do they pick up the paper?
There are the Irish Americans who are living there. There's also a separate group of people who are business people who've got investments on both sides of the Atlantic, and they shuttle back and forth. It's quite remarkable. And then there's another group of people who have a particular interest in New York are in Boston, and they want to know what's going on, for example, in the art scene in New York. And there are also people who are very keen on coming to New York to shop. You'll know that the dollar-euro rate at the moment is particularly advantageous for Europeans. So for the last 3 months, we've had a veritable army of inveterate shoppers coming over here. They land, they're extremely well-organized, Brooke. They have they usually have a giant limo to meet them at the airport. They'll have clubbed together. There might be five or six, usually women, and they'll hit the stores.
Now, I wonder, though, did you then expand the shopping section to appeal to those people? Is the echo different on each side of the Atlantic?
It's exactly the same on each side of the Atlantic, but we did extend the shopping. We now do a full page every week in which we give people the up-to-date information. It's mainly New York focused on where the latest sales are, where the bargains are. And we give them little tips to try and make them a sort of instant New Yorker when they arrive at JFK. So they know how much to tip the cab driver. They know how to avoid the queues and, you know, that type of thing. And we found that an awful lot of them arrived at JFK looking for the Echo, knowing that this existed. We've actually advertised the shopping section in some of the other media back in Ireland and reminded people that they can pick it up now in Ireland.
In editorials, the Irish Echo frequently deals with Irish politics, and in particular Northern Ireland. Irish Americans had somewhat different views than their brethren back on the island about a lot of these issues.
We are aware that Irish Americans don't always share the same politics as the Irish in Ireland. Most Irish people in Ireland, they still instinctively support the Democrats on virtually everything. They can't imagine Irish Americans voting for Republicans. But in fact, we reckon about half of our readers vote for the Republican Party and the other half vote for the Democratic Party. And we have to reflect that. We have to address that. We can't just pretend that nothing has changed since John F. Kennedy.
So you've been distributing the Irish Echo in Ireland now for about a month. How's it going?
It's going better than we expected. And we think some of it has to do with the number of shoppers coming over, which are greater than anyone anticipated.
I don't know if you're in contact with any of the other dozen immigrant newspapers that have grown up in the last century in New York. But is anybody else thinking of starting up an edition in the hometown?
I'm not sure. We haven't really been in touch with that many. Our proud boast is that we're the oldest English language newspaper of its type in New York City. Immigrant newspaper. There is one older paper, and that's The Forward. But The Forward was published in Yiddish for a long time. We play softball with them, in fact.
Thank you very much, Sean.
You're welcome.
Sean McCarty is the editor of the Irish Echo, now available on both sides of the Atlantic.
Coming up, a computer program helps you write a best-selling book, title, and books that sticky fingers can't resist.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a couple of your letters. Last week, Brooke mused with Slate's Jack Schaefer on when we boomers might lose our cultural dominance. Among many others, June in Manhattan wrote to let us know that the future is already here. I'm one boomer who is facing tremendous age discrimination and can't get a job, she writes. I've worked my entire life and now I'm apparently invisible. The cultural coup? Well, everybody gets old, so get ready.
Jennifer Wavis from Tempe, Arizona, agrees that we're witnessing the end of an era. She wrote, The rise to cultural dominance of a generation may be indicated as much by its members' seizure of media power as the previous generation's loosening grip on that same power. To wit, both Bob and Brooke mispronounced the name reggaeton during your December 16th broadcast. Correct pronunciation is reggaeton, not reggaeton. Hold on tight to your dreams of cultural hegemony, boomers, because believe it or not, FSM has already touched you with his noodly appendage.
And for you bewildered boomers out there, the Wikipedia entry for FSM says it stands for Flying Spaghetti Monster, the deity at the center of Pastafarianism, a satirical parody religion created in 2005 to protest the decision by the Kansas State Board of Education to require the teaching of intelligent design as an alternative to evolution. Keep your letters and obscure cultural references coming in to onthemedia.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Fiction authors spend a lot of time and energy contriving just the right title for their books, efforts usually unavailing, as most novels more or less wind up on the worst seller list. But there may be a way to improve a novel's chance. The proprietors of Lulu.com, a website for self-publishing authors, underwrote a statistical analysis of 50 years' worth of titles from the New York Times bestseller list. They used the data to create a computer program that takes any fiction title and quantifies its chances of becoming a bestseller. Lulu.com marketing director Peter Friedman joins me now. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, we analyzed over 700 titles, half of them number one bestsellers on the New York Times list and half of them non-bestsellers by the same authors. The key variables that differentiated the titles that had been number one bestsellers from the titles that had failed to be were whether the title was literal or figurative, the word type of the first word, though interestingly the word type of the second word didn't matter, and also the title's grammar pattern.
Okay, what is the perfect fiction title?
The perfect novel title is Sleeping Murder, which is the title of the last published novel by Agatha Christie. It was the last Miss Marple mystery. It was published in 1976, shortly after Agatha Christie's death. What's also interesting is that her earlier novels actually scored very badly on our computer model. So she obviously spent her entire career learning how to craft the perfect title.
I'm curious about this because Sleeping Murder was not by any means Agatha Christie's best-selling title. So what can you tell me to persuade me that your model is accurate, that in fact there is a correlation between titles and sales?
Yes, well, it wasn't 100% perfect, far from it, but it was nearly 70% perfect, which is 40% better than random guesswork, which, given the fact that it covers such a long period and that tastes obviously change and various other methodological difficulties, was actually a more successful model than we expected it to be. One of the surprise findings was that the length of the title did not seem to matter. Cherished publishing industry folk wisdom suggests that a bestseller should have a short title, if not just one word. But we found that the number of words in the title didn't affect its sales prospects. And another interesting finding was that titles that are figurative or metaphorical outsell those that are literal.
Apart from Sleeping Murder, tell me some of the top scoring novels of all the 700 that you fed into your system.
Very close behind Sleeping Murder was Presumed Innocent by Scott Turow, another figurative title. Also in the top 10 were Rising Sun, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Four Blind Mice, and Something of Value.
Conspicuous by their absence on your list are, for example, The Da Vinci Code and the Harry Potter novels, which are just mammoth bestsellers, and almost everything Robert Ludlum ever wrote. All of his titles follow a certain template of the word the, and then a proper noun, and then another noun, the Bourne Identity being a pretty good example. if they're so poorly titled, why have they done so well?
Well, we did another study about a year ago in which we looked at the average age of authors when they topped the New York Times bestseller list, and we found the average age was about 50 and a half years. But J.K. Rowling, one of the most successful authors to top the New York Times bestseller list, was only 34 when she first topped it. That doesn't mean that our analysis was wrong. It just means that they don't conform to the average pattern over 700 novels in 50 years. Obviously, it's important to write a good book. Obviously, a famous author is going to do better than an obscure author. But other things being equal, if you follow the equation and the pattern recommended by our title score, then your novel will sell more copies than if you don't.
Now, I haven't written any novels, but I've written a couple of nonfiction books that have not performed especially well out there.
Yes.
Nor did they score very well on your computer model. When I write my next book, no matter what the subject, I'm pretty sure the title will be Oprah's I Love Cats Diet. Now, how does that sound to you?
Well, the British equivalent used to be Golfing for Cats with a swastika on the cover. So it's almost as good.
Finally, what's the worst title you came up with?
The worst title we came up with actually doesn't sound all that bad to my ears. But just as the Sleeping Murder was the only title to score the highest available score, there was only one title to achieve the lowest available score, which was 0.09, indicating only a 9% chance of becoming a number one bestseller. And that was Cause of Death by Patricia Cornwell. Yet, in fact, several of Cornwell's other titles scored very high on our title score.
Big seller, Cause of Death.
Yes. Well, think how much bigger it would have been if it had been called Sleeping Murder. It probably would have sold twice as many.
Okay, Peter. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Friedman is marketing director at Lulu.com, a website for self-publishers.
While we're on the subject of books, this week The Sopranos began airing seasons 1 through 5 in the run-up to the 6th season, which starts in March. In the second season, a recommendation by renowned literateur Tony Soprano pushed an ancient bit of Chinese wisdom onto the bestseller list, namely The Art of War by Sun Tzu.
Reading that a book you told me about, The Art of War by Sun Tzu. I mean, here's this guy, a Chinese general, wrote this thing 2,400 years ago, and most of it still applies today. Balk the enemy's power, force him to reveal himself. You know, most of the guys that I know, they read Prince Machiavelli. And I had Carmela go and get the Cliff Notes once, and he's okay. But this book is much better about strategy.
After Tony plugged the book, not literally, on HBO, the Oxford University Press placed a small ad in the New York Times. It read, Tony Soprano fears no enemy. Sun Tzu taught him how. In an interview with the Boston Globe, Sarah Leopold of the Oxford University Press said that there was no doubt about it. The spurt was due entirely to the Sopranos. Every copy sold out. Which raised the question, would Tony's colleagues have purchased the book or gotten it off the back of a truck? Which leads ineluctably to yet another question. Book theft is rampant in this country, so who is doing the stealing? In New York City, there are tables lining avenues all over town, overflowing with books that have fallen off the back of trucks. The deal is, the boosters steal the books, sell them to the guys with the tables for a quarter of the cover price, and they sell it to the rest of us for half of the cover price. Except that we would never do that. Who would buy a stolen book? For that matter, who would steal a book? Back in 2001, we asked New York Observer columnist and author Ron Rosenbaum, who thinks he knows who.
I was going to write a column about the kinds of people who like Bukowski and Burroughs, the killer bees, I thought. There's a certain personality type. And then I tried to buy a couple of Bukowski books. I found they're not on the shelves of this Barnes & Noble. They're behind the counter. Then a couple weeks later, I went back to get a Martin Amis, He's not on the shelves. He's behind the counter. Then a couple weeks later, I went to try to get a Raymond Chandler as a gift to someone. He's behind the counter. And suddenly it crept up on me. I realized that Barnes & Noble has a kind of shoplift wall of fame or wall of shame, all the most frequently shoplifted books.
Ron Rosenbaum is the author of a collection of nonfiction called The Secret Parts of Fortune. He got the Barnes & Noble clerk to share the list of the most shoplifted. Barnes & Noble declined to answer our questions, so consider the following privileged information.
Here's the authors they gave me. Martin Amis, Paul Auster, Georges Bataille, William Burroughs, Italo Calvino, Raymond Chandler, Michel Foucault, Dashiell Hammett, Jack Kerouac, and Jeanette Winterson.
On both coasts and points in between, Bukowski is the number one choice of book bandits, and Rosenbaum has formed a personality profile of the perpetrators.
There's a certain kind of person who feels that Bukowski and Burroughs and literature that, you know, dwells incessantly on excrement and vomit and the lower depths is literature about the truth. And I guess they identify with these down-and-out heroes, and so they feel that that somehow validates their desire to just shoplift the books.
Of course, Rosenbaum, who's authored a few books himself, thinks they're fooling themselves.
You know, if you look at who's actually doing the shoplifting, they're not really down-and-out, lower-depths types, but like to pose as being down-and-out, and shoplifting is part of the aura. You know, so I call the frequent shoplifter of Burroughs and Bukowski Bukowski man, because they're always saying, oh yeah, Bukowski man. Only Bukowski man really lays it on the line. He's the only one who can tell the truth, dude.
But the majority of book thefts are not the work of the Bukowski man. Tom Cushman, who managed a number of bookstores in this city, currently Ivy's and Murder, Inc., says thieves are not motivated by literary notions or even personal taste, except for money.
It's a romantic notion, but the thing is that book theft is really a much more pedestrian thing. It's no different than stealing anything else.
Books don't have to portray drug abuse or actionable sexual practices to attract the professional.
When the Harry Potter book came out, we kept those behind the counter.
Presumably not from a light-fingered pre-adolescence.
No, certainly not. I mean, that book was such a popular theft item that even the guys who deliver the boxes of books to us were stealing them. That was definitely a hot item on the streets.
Whether a book is ripe for the five-finger discount depends on a few key factors, says Cushman. Location. Are they tucked away or in plain view of the clerk? Resale prospects. Did I mention Harry Potter? And yes, thieves do judge a book by its cover, especially those of attractive trade paperbacks, like Paul Auster's.
Where I really came into a great deal of contact with book theft, I was a manager at a Rizzoli down in Soho, and there we had like seven authors that were the most popular stolen books. And out of the seven, Paul Auster was actually the only living author. He had the distinction of being the only living author who was most stolen.
Well, all I can say is I'm mystified. I don't know what to make of it at all.
Novelist Paul Auster is the author of many books, though his New York trilogy is the most stolen.
I guess you feel pleased that there are people who actually want to read you so much they're willing to break the law to do it. But at the same time, you feel that, maybe your work just appeals to the criminal element in society. I mean, I don't know.
Bookstore manager Tom Cushman says that in his experience, book crooks are not breaking the law to read.
I had a whole stack once of about 20 or 30 copies of the New York trilogy of his that somebody just came in and just took the whole stack.
Would Auster feel better if he knew readers rather than professional thieves were stealing his books?
Yes, I suppose I would. Somehow mixing commerce into all this makes it a little unsavory. If it were some passionate, poor person who wanted to read the book, then I could understand it a little better.
One place where the book thief is more likely to read what he hath took is the public library. And library theft tends to lean toward the practical more than the popular. News you can use, so to speak. How-to books ranging from auto repair to divorce, how to ace the GEDs and the joy of sex. Also anything, and this is from libraries across the country, anything to do with witchcraft, the occult, UFOs, or astrology. And there are some other popular choices for the kleptomaniacally inclined. the Bible, for instance. Ron Rosenbaum.
Well, I guess the people who are shoplifting haven't had a chance to flip through the Ten Commandments, you know, to thou shalt not steal, you know. Maybe afterwards they'll return them out of remorse.
When we did that piece, we asked the press officer for the American Library Association, Lara Clark, to conduct a national ad hoc email poll of library theft for On the Media. She heard from 70 libraries across the country. She said that one name that never, ever came up was Charles Bukowski.
You know, I personally, I've got to admit, didn't know who that was. And it didn't come up anywhere in my questioning to people.
So what's with the five copies of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus being stolen from Orchard Beach, Maine?
You know, who knows? Are people embarrassed to buy it?
You did get a response from a prison library.
We did hear from a prison library, and the dictionary was their most frequently stolen, and books of poetry.
I was very interested in the behavior of some moral guardians of the community that some of the librarians wrote about.
Right. The idea that people would remove books from our collections because they don't want anyone to have access to them is very troubling.
For instance, one library in Maine went through three copies of Heather Has Two Mommies.
I think it's unfortunate that people will resort to stealing to kind of force their will on a library community. There's a minister that works with the Library Association, and one of the things he says about that is, he's like, you know, if you can take this book out of the library, what's going to keep you from taking my favorite book, which is the Bible, out of the library?
And a lot of people do steal the Bible.
They do, actually. A couple of librarians, including one in Salt Lake City, she said that the Bible was their most frequently stolen book.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
We spoke to American Library Association press officer Lara Clark in 2001.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.